issues in Christian theology that are relevant to economics. And the first on the list there on your syllabus is the idea of creation. The idea of creation. You won't find the idea outside of the Bible. You don't find it in the ancient philosophers. You don't find it in the ancient poets. You do find the idea of an omnipotent God creating the world out of nothing in the Bible, in Genesis 1, in John 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Nothing that was made without the Word. What relevance does this have for economics? It has profound impact on economics. For one thing, it teaches us that the universe, the world, is rational. Just as God is rational, His creation is rational. That is, His creation makes logical sense. The creation makes logical sense. It's a denial of the modern philosophical view that the world is absurd, that there's no sense to it. It's a denial of that. You find that view expressed in particular in existentialism. Everything is absurd. It's irrational. It's illogical. It makes no sense. And that is denied in the doctrine of creation. God is rational, and His creation is rational. The Word that creates the world is eternal. The Logos that creates the world is eternal. This has another implication. The idea of logic precedes the existence of the world. The logic precedes the world. The Word comes first. The Word comes first. The Word is not, as we find it in the theory of evolution, the mind of man is not something that comes much later, after the Big Bang or whatever. In current cosmology, the Big Bang happened 15 billion years ago, and then the mind of man, which begins to think rationally, appears within the past, 200,000 years. So you have 15 billion years of nothing being rational, nothing being logical. And then for some reason, the universe coughs up man, and all of a sudden you have rational thought. The complete reversal of what the Bible teaches about origins. Mind does not come from non-mind as in evolution. In Christianity, what is non-mind, the visible world, comes from mind. The mind is first. The mind is God, is rational, and the universe is rational. Well, this has a tremendous impact in how we view nature, and how we view nature, how we view the things around us. If you look at the opening chapters of Genesis, for example, let's turn to Genesis 1, 2, and 3, right at the beginning of the book. And let's look at beginning in chapter 1, verse 26, then God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in His own image. In the image of God, He created him, male and female, He created them. Then God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves on the earth. Here you have the motivation for God for creating man stated, and you have His instruction to man to have dominion over the earth and everything on it. Notice that He is not given dominion over man. There is no mention of man's dominion over man. That comes later, after the fall. But in the pure creation, we are given dominion. Man is given dominion over nature. Now, this is a consequence of man being created in the image of God. And this is an idea peculiar, unique to Christianity. Man is the image of God. And also, man is having dominion over the non-human nature, whatever it might be. This is unique to Christianity. And this is a central idea that contributes to the economic development of the West. This is a central idea that contributes to the economic development of the West. The idea that the world is placed here for the benefit and use of mankind. That's exactly what the Bible says. And this idea led to the economic development, combined with some other ideas we'll talk about, to the economic development of the West. It explains also why societies that did not share this doctrine of creation and this doctrine of nature did not develop to the extent that the West has. They developed somewhat, but they never developed to the extent the West has. The ordinary things that we enjoy today were dreamed of by kings, ancient kings, having such a thing as a refrigerator where you can keep your food cold. This was quite an accomplishment in ancient times. Having such things as indoor plumbing was quite an accomplishment. And we take all these things for granted. Air conditioning was almost unheard of. If you were the Pharaoh, perhaps you could hire some people to fan you as you sat on your throne. But to sit in a cooled room such as this, unheard of. This economic development is fantastic in the history of the world, if you study world history. Well, it's precisely this Christian idea that man has dominion over nature and the purpose of nature is to benefit man that has come under attack in the past 30 years or so in the environmental movement. I'm going to read to you a few paragraphs from an essay that was published in 1967 in the very influential journal Science by Lynn White, Jr. And he makes some fascinating comments about Christianity and the environmental movement. Now, keep in mind, this is more than 30 years ago, 1967. The environmental movement is just beginning in the 1960s. You've had some books published already, but it's just getting underway. And here is what White argues. The title of the essay is "The Historical Roots of Our Ecologic Crisis." The historical roots of our ecologic crisis. And we've all heard of ecology and the environmental movement and all of that. And he says, among other things here, the leadership of the West, both in technology and in science, is far older than the so-called scientific revolution of the 17th century or the so-called industrial revolution of the 18th century. It says, by the year 1000, at the latest, perhaps feebly, as much as two centuries earlier, the West began to apply water power to industrial processes other than milling grain. Now, water power had been used to mill grain for centuries. Now, in the year 1000, you find the Europeans using water power to do other things other than mill grain. And then the use of wind power is developed. He goes on and he argues, until Christianity came along, he says, formerly man had been part of nature. Obviously, if man evolved, if man was a natural creature, if man was not the image of God, then man was simply part of nature. He says, formerly man had been part of nature, now he was the exploiter of nature, that is, under the influence of Christianity. Nowhere else in the world did farmers develop any analogous agricultural implement, that is, analogous to the plow. Is it coincidence that modern technology, with its ruthlessness toward nature, has so largely been produced by descendants of these peasants of Northern Europe? He talks about the victory of Christianity over paganism in the early Roman Empire. Continuing with White, he says, in the account of creation in Genesis, man named all the animals. You recall Adam doing that, thus establishing his dominance over them. God planned all of this explicitly for man's benefit and rule. No item in the physical creation had any purpose save to serve man's purposes. And although man's body is made of clay, he is not simply part of nature. He is made in God's image. Man shares in great measure God's transcendence of nature. And he contrasts this view with the ancient view. He says, in antiquity, and he spells antiquity with a capital A, every tree, every spring, every stream, every hill had its own genius loci, its guardian spirit. These spirits were accessible to men, but were very unlike men. Centaurs, fauns, and mermaids show their ambivalence. Before one cut a tree, mined a mountain, or dammed a brook, it was important to placate the spirit in charge of that particular situation, and to keep it placated. By destroying pagan animism, Christianity made it possible to exploit nature in a mood of indifference to the feelings of natural objects. Now, you can imagine this situation of animism in ancient society, in which every tree, every mountain, every brook is indwelt by some sort of spirit. And in order to do anything, you have to placate that spirit and keep it placated. People don't stop to think about it. Lynn White has. But that sort of theology, that sort of idolatry, inhibits economic development. It inhibits economic development. It prevents it. It thwarts it. It slows it down. He goes on to talk about the cult of the saints that developed in the Middle Ages, and to some extent how that continued the animism of pagan society, of pagan Rome. Now you have papal Rome encouraging the worship of the saints, and today Rome has hundreds, if not thousands, of saints for everything. Saints for lost objects, saints for travel, saints for accountants. You name it. Every activity, every profession has a saint. And this is analogous to the animistic spirits of ancient society. And you pray to those saints, or you pray to those spirits, or you offer sacrifices to them. You placate them somehow, so that your endeavor will succeed. And he continues in this essay talking about God's revelation in the Bible and how this undermined ancient paganism. He says that Christianity bears a huge burden of the guilt for our environmental crisis. He says, our science and technology have grown out of Christian attitudes toward man's relationship to nature, which are almost universally held not only by Christians and neo-Christians, but also by those who fondly regard themselves as post-Christians, 20th century Americans. Despite Copernicus, all the cosmos rotates around our little globe, he says. Despite Darwin, we are not, in our hearts, part of the natural process. That is, people have accepted evolution, but they are reluctant to accept the implication that we are simply a natural being, even secularists. Now, those who have been consistent, or more consistent, in accepting Darwin, see the implication here, that we, as a species, have no right to say that mankind is superior to any other species. If we could argue with a rhinoceros, we might say, well, what's important is brain size. That's what's important in a species. And the rhinoceros might reply, well, what's important is thickness of one's hide. That's what's important. That's what makes a superior species. Or if we could argue with a cockroach in this evolutionary fantasy, we could say, well, what's important is prehensile thumbs, opposable thumbs. And the cockroach would say, no, what's important is the ability to survive nuclear war. And the cockroach, of course, has been around for, the evolutionists tell us, hundreds of millions of years. Very ancient species. We haven't, Lynn White complains, completely accepted the implications of evolution. And we have to, he says. He says, the whole concept of a sacred grove, and there were sacred groves, you can read about them, in the Old Testament. The pagans had sacred groves of trees, stands of trees, sacred groves. Says, the whole concept of a sacred grove is alien to Christianity. Read the Old Testament. You'll see how some of the kings had them chopped down because of their paganism. Says, it's alien to Christianity and to the ethos of the West. For nearly two millennia, Christian missionaries have been chopping down sacred groves, which are idolatrous. Well, today we have sacred groves in the U.S. We call them wilderness areas. The god that we're worshiping is Mother Nature. That's the goddess that replaced God the Father, Mother Nature. They also hark back to the ancient word, Gaia, for Mother Nature, and sometimes you'll come across an article in the newspaper or see something on TV about the worship of the goddess. It's a very theological movement, the environmental movement, and they talk about the worship of Gaia. He says, Lynn White continues, more science and more technology are not going to get us out of the present crisis until we find a new religion or rethink our old one. Well, you've got plenty of that, plenty of both of those things going on. He suggests Zen Buddhism as our new religion. But then he thinks perhaps this is too great, too traumatic, a split or a divergence from Christianity. So he tries to find something within the history of the West that he can recommend. And he does so. He picks on, St. Francis of Assisi, not St. Francis of Camaro, but St. Francis of Assisi. I don't know if you've read anything about Francis of Assisi in Italy, but this is Lynn White's interpretation of him. Francis took very literally the command to go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. He says we have to preach to every creature. It doesn't say to every man. It says to every creature. So he went out and he preached to birds and dogs and squirrels and whatever. Simply went out and preached to every creature. This is what Lynn White writes about Francis. He says, Francis tried to depose man from his monarchy over creation and set up a democracy of all God's creatures. He said Francis developed the doctrine of the animal soul. That is, animals can understand and be saved. And so on and so forth. And he suggests St. Francis as the model for the new religion that we have to adopt. He says that at the conclusion of his article, we shall continue to have a worsening environmental crisis until we reject the Christian axiom that nature has no reason for existence save to serve man. The roots of our trouble are largely religious. The remedy must also be religious. We must rethink and refeel our nature and our destiny. And he concludes by saying, I propose St. Francis as the patron saint for ecologists. Now, this is a man who understands quite clearly the impact that the Christian doctrine of creation, the Christian doctrine of man, had on the economic development of the West. He understands it quite clearly, better than many Christians. And he hates Christianity for that reason. And, you know, sometimes opponents of Christianity understand it better than Christians do. And here's a case of something like that happening. You see it in the New Testament. The Pharisees understand what Christ is saying better than the disciples do. That's precisely the reason the Pharisees hate him so much. They understand that he is claiming to be God. It takes the disciples some time to catch on. But the Pharisees understand this quite clearly. They don't believe it, but they understand it. And Lynn White understands some of the implications of the doctrine of creation. He doesn't believe in the doctrine of creation. He hates the doctrine, and he says we have to have a new religion. We have to return to the old idolatry. He says, and this will prevent the economic development that has brought us to the present crisis if we return to the old religion. Give me that old-time religion. The phrase has a new twist in Lynn White here. He means really old. Give me that old-time religion. So there you have a group of ideas related to economics that are of profound importance in understanding economic theory, in understanding the history of the West, how things developed. The second group I'd like to talk about here is family and future. We read the account of Esau the other day, how Esau traded away his birthright for a bowl of soup. He had no orientation toward the future whatsoever. He was interested in immediate gratification, immediate satisfaction. I want it now. You know, we sometimes, years ago, you heard a generation called the now generation. We want it now. Well, it wasn't new. It goes at least back to Esau. That attitude that I want immediate satisfaction, immediate gratification. I'm not going to wait. The future can take care of itself. No anticipation of the future. No attempt to anticipate the future. He says, I want my satisfaction now. On the other hand, in Christianity, we're encouraged to think about the future. In fact, we're encouraged to think about eternity. Not only the future on this earth, but we're encouraged to think about the fact that we are going to live forever. Each of us will live forever. The only question is, will we spend that eternity in a situation of uninterrupted happiness, or will we spend that eternity in a situation of uninterrupted misery? That's the question. But Christianity encourages people not only to think about next year or what they're going to do with their lives on earth, but how they're going to spend eternity. Nothing could be more future-oriented than that. Nothing. And when Christ says, as we read the other day again, you know, what shall it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul, he's encouraging his listeners to think about the future, to think where riches and fame and power are going to get them in the world to come. And if they have to lose their souls to gain riches and fame and power, influence, reputation, whatever, then they're losers. They've lost. Nothing is more important than the salvation of one's own soul. Nothing. And this orientation toward the future expresses itself somewhat in the structure of the family. That is, we are to be concerned about not only our future as heads of families, but about the future of our children, about the future of our children's children. There is a covenantal relationship here. And we have to look forward, not just to the end of our lives, but we have to look forward to their lives and our children's children's lives. And keep in mind those things. It used to be that, and we're told in Scripture, by Paul again, that parents ought to lay up for their children, not children for their parents. That is, parents have the obligation of providing for their children, and if possible, leaving an inheritance to their children. Parents ought to lay up for their children. The scriptural ideal, the scriptural norm, is not that the parents become a burden to their children in their old age. Sometimes that's unavoidable. Sometimes the parent gets sick. Or sometimes the father will be killed and leaves the widow without means of support other than the children. Sometimes it's unavoidable. But the norm is, the ideal is, that the parents would provide not only for their own future, but leave an inheritance for their children. They're to think that far ahead. Today, however, to apply this to politics, to a couple of political issues, the enormous federal debt that we have accumulated means that this generation is leaving not an inheritance for the children, but a burden for the children as a whole society. It's not leaving an inheritance, it's leaving a debt of at least $6 trillion. The opposite of what Paul commands to be done. This sort of enormous debt violates Paul's commands about what parents are supposed to do for their children. So work and rest. These things go along with it as well. In the Bible, you'll find a God revealed quite different from the pagan gods. In the Bible, God works. And you find it not only in the opening chapters of Genesis, where it says God created the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh, stopped working, but you'll find it in many statements of Christ, for example, in the Gospels, where he says, the Father works, and I work. The Father works, and I work. Now, this is quite different from pagan gods. If you have read about the Roman or the Greek deities, that's about the last thing they do is work. They're a bunch of spoiled brats. They party. They scheme. They engage in all sorts of immoral behavior. They're envious of men. They cause disruption on earth. Last thing they do, if they ever do it at all, is work. That is, they do not have a purpose in mind other than their own partying or their own maliciousness. They have no task to which they apply themselves, accomplish, and finish. Now, the God of the Bible, however, is quite different. The God of the Bible works for 6 days in creating the world. Jesus works. He says he works many times. I do the work of him who sent me. Look up the word work in a concordance and go through the Gospels and see how many times Jesus talks about God the Father working and he himself working. Now this gives a dignity to work that no pagan religion can. You have here a God working. You have here God the Son working on earth. And it gives a dignity to ordinary work that no pagan religion can ever give. What developed at the time of the Reformation was something called the Protestant work ethic. The Protestant work ethic. What did the ethic consist of? Well, if you read, again, Max Weber's book, The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, you'll see what this work ethic consists of. And sometimes you'll hear programs on TV or in the press read stories about the disappearance of the work ethic in modern society. What do they mean by the work ethic? Well, they mean industriousness. Industriousness. That is, people actually apply themselves to a task. They choose a task to do, a worthwhile thing to do, and they apply themselves. They work honestly. That is, if they're an employee, they give a full day's work for a full day's pay. They don't goof off. They get the job done. They work honestly for their employer. If they're not an employee, if they're an employer, they work honestly. They're paid for the project, and they do the project according to specifications, or better than specifications. They don't cut corners. They work honestly. They repay their debt on time, in full. If they borrow money, they don't let it slide. They don't default. They don't file for bankruptcy. They repay their debt on time and in full. It consists of humility. That's part of the work ethic. The idea that you as an employee or you as a businessman are the servant of the person that you're working for or working with. If I am working for someone, I am his servant. I am to follow his instructions, unless they're immoral. If he tells me to cheat a customer or something like that, that's a different question. But if he tells me what the job is, when it's to be done, how it's to be done, I'm to follow his instructions. I'm to be teachable. I'm to be humble in that sense. I'm to be, part of the work ethic is frugality. You don't waste resources. You use them wisely. You try to get the most benefit for the expenditure that you can. You don't waste things. Part of it is individual responsibility. That is, you regard yourself as being obligated to support yourself. The world doesn't owe you a living. Many people have that attitude. The world owes me a living. Many educated people have that attitude. They think that once they get their PhDs, they should be treated. They should be paid for things that they don't do or things that they don't produce just because they have a PhD. Nonsense. You're paid or ought to be paid for what you produce. Not because you have some letters after your name. It's productivity. If the labor services, whatever you produce, if you manufacture things, that's what counts. Part of the idea of the work ethic is self-control. Self-control. That means that you have discipline. If you're supposed to show up for work at 8 o'clock, you show up and be ready to work by 8 o'clock. If you quit at 5, you stay until 5. You don't show up drunk for work. One of the greatest problems American companies have had in the 20th century is when they build factories overseas or down in Latin America, one of their greatest problems is finding employees who have some sort of work ethic. And that's because in many of these countries, there's been no Christianity. There's been no Protestantism to teach them the work ethic. And they have to deal with problems such as, well, in Latin America, people get paid on Friday, and they figure that's enough, so I don't need any money next week. I won't show up next week. No, it's a simple thing like that, the idea that once you have a job, you show up for work, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, at 8 in the morning or whatever. And when you get paid, you don't fail to come in the next week. You come back the next week, even though you've been paid enough to last you a week. And you don't, you know, these are simple things that we may not even think of. But these are problems in other countries that U.S. companies find out about when they set up factories in other countries. Punctuality. Showing up for work, ready for work. Showing up for work sober. Coming in on Monday. don't spend the weekend in a long drunken stupor, and you can't work during the week. Now, we're losing the work ethic in the U.S., and this is precisely the problems that are showing up in the U.S. now. People showing up for work, if not drunk with alcohol, drunk with drugs. That's why many employers give drug tests to see what's going on here. The work ethic is quickly disappearing in the U.S. Why? We shouldn't be surprised. Because Christianity has virtually disappeared in the U.S. Well, continuing here with the idea of production, the book, Production and Envy here, the book I mentioned yesterday and couldn't think of the author of, his name is Helmut, H-E-L-M-U-T, Scheck, S-C-H-O-E-C-K. The title of the book is simply Envy. Envy. I urge you to buy it. Buy it and read it. Scheck is not a Christian. The book is 25 years old. It's not a Christian. It's about a 400-page book. But you'll find it fascinating. Because what he does is he takes the idea of envy or resentment and he traces it through different societies. He traces it in the field of literature, in politics, in government action, in history. And he gives many examples of the economic effects of envy. The economic effects of envy. So if you don't read any other book after this course in the field of economics, read Envy by Helmut Scheck. What does he argue? Well, he argues that any society which does not condemn envy as a sin will never develop economically. Any society which does not condemn envy as a sin will not develop economically. And he gives many examples of arrested societies. Many examples. From the North American Indians to tribes in Africa and Asia. How does this affect production, this envy? Well, if a man discovers that he can do something very well, better than others, let's say he can catch more fish, or he can hunt better, whatever it might be, what immediately comes into play is the envy of his brothers, the envy of his fellow tribesmen. They think that he owes them those extra fish. He owes them that extra deer. They want it. They're envious of him. He owes it to them. In the United States, he gives examples of envy in crime. A few years ago, Cornell University in New York had a fire, 1968, I guess it was, in which a special program that they had for receiving your PhD in 5 years. Some very bright students enrolled in the program. Someone set the building in which they were housed on fire. Why? Well, the Cornell administrator said it appeared that some student was jealous of those enrolled in this program. Scheck gives newspaper accounts of one girl taking a razor to the face of her roommate because she was envious of her roommate's good looks. She couldn't stand the fact that she was not as pretty as her roommate. So if she could not be that pretty, her roommate wasn't going to be that pretty. So she took a razor to her face. There's an old joke about envy. The genie encounters four men of different nations and offers them to give them their fondest wish. And he asked the Englishman what would his fondest wish be. And the Englishman's reply is, I want to be a world-famous novelist. And the genie says, it's done. You're going to be the world-famous novelist. And then he asked the Frenchman what his fondest wish is. And the Frenchman says, I want to be the world's best winemaker. And the genie says, it's done. You're the world's best winemaker. Then he asked an American what his fondest wish is. And the American says, I want to be the world's greatest industrialist. And the genie says, fine, you will be the world's greatest industrialist. And then he asks the Russian what his fondest wish is. And the Russian's reply is, I wish my neighbor's cow would die. That's envy. He doesn't want to achieve anything of his own. He doesn't want to produce anything of his own. All he can think about is the fact that his neighbor has a cow and he doesn't. And his wish is that his neighbor's cow would die. And this is the attitude of resentment. You saw it in some degree in Matthew 20, in the parable of the vineyard, where the people are resentful that the employer gives some of the employees, more than they got. And they resent it. And in that parable, the owner of the vineyard tells them to go home. Take their money and go away. So you agreed to work for a denarius? What's the problem? Are you mad at me because I'm paying them more? I'm being generous with them? Are you mad at me for that? That's what they're mad at him for. They're mad at him because he has been generous with the other employees. This is the feeling, this is the emotion, this is the sin of envy or resentment. And it has profound impact in economic growth, in economic development. I've got to cut it off here, don't I? Well, save your questions, and we'll pick it up again in 15 minutes, please. What's one of the institutional examples of envy in the United States today? The graduated income tax. The graduated income tax, sometimes called the progressive tax, says that if you earn $20,000, you pay 15% of your income to the government. If you earn $50,000, you pay 28% of your income to the government. If you earn $100,000, you pay 33% of your income to your government. That is, the percentage goes up. It's not a flat tax. It's not a tax in the sense that everybody pays the same percentage of their income. This tax was made constitutional in 1913 by the passage of the 16th Amendment to the Constitution. Prior to this time, the Supreme Court had declared an income tax unconstitutional. The federal government had tried it before, and I believe it was 1896. The court said it's unconstitutional. You can't tax incomes under the Constitution. In 1913, the states were persuaded to adopt the 16th Amendment, making an income tax constitutional. And at the time, the American people were sold on the idea because they were told that the ordinary man, the ordinary working man, would never pay this tax. It was a tax aimed only at the rich, that it was designed to make them pay their fair share rather than getting off nearly free, as it were. And the appeal was to envy. The rich were held up as objects of envy, resentment. And the income tax is the common man's tool of cutting them down to size. So we're going after the Rockefellers. And we're going after the Carnegies. And we're going after these malefactors of great wealth who have accumulated millions of dollars because, well, to use another phrase that's come into being lately, they have deep pockets. This is where the money is. And if you adopt this amendment to the Constitution, if we pass this law setting up the income tax, then we can get the money from the rich. All of it based on envy. It's all based on envy. Of course, sometimes that envy masquerades as justice. The employees in Matthew 20 in the vineyard felt that an injustice had been done to them. And the employer, the vineyard owner, says, no, nothing. I haven't done you any wrong. We agreed on this wage. I paid you this wage. Go home. I haven't done you any wrong. But the envy was masquerading as a concern about justice there, and it masqueraded as a concern about justice in 1913, and it masquerades as a concern about justice today. In fact, we have a phrase for it, social justice. It's a fancy word for envy. Fancy phrase for envy. It's the idea that we go after the rich. Anybody who catches more fish or bags a deer has to turn it over to us. Same motivation as in primitive society. Same effect. It stifles economic development in primitive societies and in industrial societies. The envy stifles economic development. Why bother working more? Why bother expanding your business if your taxes are going to double or quadruple? Why bother? Not everyone will make that decision, but many people will. It will stifle economic development. Another thing, before we go on here, I'd like to read to you what Max Weber, the German economist, who wrote The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, has to say about greed. You notice when I talked about the Protestant ethic or the work ethic, the greed wasn't one of the factors in it. And this is what Weber writes about greed. He says, "The universal reign of absolute unscrupulousness in the pursuit of selfish interests by the making of money has been a specific characteristic of precisely those countries whose capitalistic development measured according to Western standards has remained backward." And then catch his next sentence. "Capitalism cannot make use of the labor of those who practice the doctrine of undisciplined greed any more than it can make use of the businessman who seems absolutely unscrupulous in his dealings with others, as we can learn from Benjamin Franklin. Hence, the difference does not lie in the degree of development of any impulse to make money." What he's saying is, men have always been greedy. You can't attribute the development of capitalism to greed. And if you look at societies, ancient societies, you'll see many examples of greed. In modern societies, you'll see many examples. In non-capitalistic societies, greed is not an explanation. In fact, he says, capitalism can't survive unless greed is curbed. And we talked about this earlier with regard to racism, how the marketplace curbs the practice of any racial discrimination if the marketplace is allowed to function. And the marketplace curbs, it does not encourage, it curbs unscrupulousness and it curbs greed. Businessmen succeed not because they're unscrupulous, but because they deliver the goods promised, time after time after time. Again, if you want to read an interesting book, read The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism. Well, continuing here with justification by faith alone, what's that got to do with economics? This is the doctrine that Luther discovered in the New Testament at the time of the Reformation. I mentioned it earlier. He stopped believing in justification by works. He was justified by the work of Christ alone. That is, Christ had accomplished his justification. He was not called to accomplish his justification. Luther and all Christians receive justification as a gift, simply by believing the gospel. Now, this was very liberating psychologically, not only for Luther, but for the Europeans, the Germans, and the Swiss, and the English, the Dutch, in the 16th century. Very liberating. No longer did they worry about doing those works that were necessary for salvation. Salvation was a gift. The church had taught them that salvation depended upon their doing religious works, observing the sacraments, praying to Mary and the saints, attending Mass. All of these religious, all of these ecclesiastical works were the means of salvation. Others had said it's not only ecclesiastical and religious works. It's charitable works that are the good works we have to do to achieve salvation. Luther and the Reformers come along and they say, no, the ordinary work that you do in your everyday life, if you're a homemaker, if you're a milkmaid, if you're a farmer, if you're a carpenter, if you're a blacksmith, if you do these out of gratitude to God for His gift of salvation, if you work, as Paul commands, as though you were working for God, for Christ, and not for a mere man, he says, this is pleasing to God. This is pleasing to God. So you have this enormous change in the value of ordinary work. Up till this time, the ordinary workers were at best second-class citizens. At best. They were concerned about things that are at best indifferent, at worst immoral. They were concerned about economic things. They were concerned about things having to do with taking care of your health, taking care of your body, taking care of your family. They were not concerned about the things of God. This is the doctrine of the medieval church. And Luther came along and said, these are of concern to God. And these works are much more valuable than the works of all the monks and nuns in all the monasteries in Christendom. And the results of his teaching were many of the monks and nuns fled the convents and the seminary and the monasteries. Well, justification by faith alone is one of the keys to understanding the development of the West, because through this doctrine, people are given, as we talked about the other day, the new desires, the new habits of thought, the new habits of mind that lead to changes in society. Finally, liberty of conscience and freedom of religion. The Reformation, again, achieves the end of ecclesiastical totalitarianism. Up until Luther, there's one church. And outside that church is no salvation. That's what the church says. Outside this church is no salvation. One church. Luther, one man, stands up and challenges 1,000 years of tradition. 1,000 years of tradition. And he was continually reproached by those who say, do you think you alone are right? Are you alone right, Martin? This is arrogance. To stand up and say, 1,000 years the church has been wrong. This is what Luther does. And he even doubts himself at times. But then he goes back and he reads the scripture. And he realizes that the man on his side is greater than all the church. And he continues his preaching of the gospel. Religious freedom is a result. Religious freedom is a result of this. And religious freedom is the basis of all other freedoms. If you look, you can see that very clearly in the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. What is the first freedom mentioned in the First Amendment? Freedom of religion. Freedom of religion. Out of that, and out of the Reformation, grows freedom of the press. That is, these Christians want the right to publish their opinions. Geneva, under Calvin, becomes one big printing press. Prints their brochures and their pamphlets and their books and spreads them all over Europe. It's the proclamation of the gospel in written form. This is what had been suppressed for 1,000 years. The printing of the Bible, even. In fact, the Bible had been placed on the index of forbidden books by the medieval church. Now we have freedom of the press, growing out of freedom of religion. Freedom of speech. The freedom to speak freely about the gospel. To express your opinions. developed out of the freedom of religion, the freedom of assembly. The next freedom mentioned in the First Amendment, the freedom of assembly. Christians were forbidden to assemble in the Middle Ages, apart from assembling for Mass. If anybody had a Bible study or some sort of religious gathering, they were persecuted. The freedom of assembly grows out of the Reformation. All of these things, all of these different freedoms mentioned, are dependent upon freedom of religion. You find, of course, going back to the first century, the disciples encountering the opposition of pagan Rome. And sometimes you'll find their statements, which later develop into these ideas. Peter says, when he's commanded to be quiet, we ought to obey God rather than man. And he continues speaking. Peter is asserting his right to speak. Peter is asserting here that he has an obligation to speak.